loud and clear.
Now we turn to a bigger bird's eye view of the demonstrations across the country. Protests are nothing new in American society, and protests for racial justice are certainly nothing new. But has America not learned any lessons from the civil rights movement? Have we learned nothing from decades of the police clashing with peaceful marchers? Why is this still happening in America in the year 2020? Why are our police departments militarized and so willing to use violence against citizens? Dr. Gerald Horn will try to answer some of those questions and others, and he joins us from Houston. He's a professor of history at the University of Houston and the author of many books, including Race to Revolution, the U.S. and Cuba During Slavery and Jim Crow. Dr. Horn, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for inviting me.
I want to ask you this right off the bat. Donald Trump made a statement several days ago, about a week ago, in which he used the term martial law. It was as though he were goading groups of marchers and people seeking justice into doing something terrible, into turning violent, into starting riots. And what that seemed to do was to bring people together and to consolidate some of these social justice movements. Can you give us your thoughts on the first week or so of this uprising?
Well, let us hope that it is a turning point in the troubled history of the United States of America. And let me also say that the people of Washington, D.C. have a special obligation, not least because it's probably simpler for the oath and the Oval Office to bring in the military to the federal district as opposed to the state. And we already know that Washington, D.C. is one of the most heavily surveilled, heavily policed cities on planet Earth, not only with the Metropolitan Police Department and the FBI, the CIA, Treasury agents, the Secret Service, the Park Police, the Capitol Police. The list is long. And we also know that you should take very seriously the rather and increasingly lunatic tweets of Mr. Trump, one of which promised and pledged to unleash, quote, ominous weapons, unquote, against the people of Washington, D.C. This is when he was chased into the bunker. Bunker Boy is now trending on Twitter, and I dare say that that image of him speeding hysterically into the bowels underneath the White House and helping to undermine his alleged heroic image has caused this counterreaction on his part. But in any case, the ominous weapons we already see in police departments from the Atlantic to the Pacific, we already know that the Pentagon supplies police departments with bazookas, armored personnel carriers, grenade launchers, etc. And you can bet your bottom dollar that there are such weapons now in place around the White House. And I would also dare say that they're probably anti-aircraft weapons, believe it or not. I don't think the protesters are going to be coming in an aircraft, but once again, let a word to the wise be sufficient. But in any case, I think that the protests are significant for a number of reasons. Number one, what I was just making reference to, that is to say the direct frontal challenge to state power at the White House, but not only there, but the burning to a crisp of the police precinct in Minneapolis where Mr. Floyd was, where officers were dispatched to assassinate Mr. Floyd. And of course, the breaching of security at the state capitol in Columbus, Ohio. This is very significant, and we need to think about it very carefully. But on the other hand, I think that we also need to think carefully about the fact that we're basically dealing with a kind of leaderless protest movement. We know that that's a reaction to the fact that when you have centralized political organizations that arise, such as the Black Panther Party in the 1960s, they're crushed relentlessly, and therefore our movement adapts by adopting the decentralized model of Black Lives Matter. But it's going to be very difficult going forward to just exist on spontaneity and exist on decentralization, although I'm well aware of the dilemma that we face when centralized organizations arise and then they're crushed. And then there's the root of the issue, which I'm afraid to say even some of our friends on the left do not seem to grasp, which is that why is it that it seems to be Black men who are captured on tape being murdered, be it Philando Castile or Eric Garner or now George Floyd? And you have to understand slavery, which seems to be beyond the ken of many of our friends on the left. They seem to not understand the profundity of living in a former slaveholder's republic. They do not seem to understand the double whammy that Black people face. That is to say, number one, being treated even today like enslaved property. That is to say, as our ancestors were treated, rather harshly, in an intimidating fashion, and brutally. And then number two, perhaps even more significant, is that many of our ancestors, by several orders of magnitude, did not support the creation of the United States of America, as I've stated clearly in my book, The Counter-Revolution of 1776, because it was the so-called revolution was led by slaveholders, such as the real estate speculator George Washington and his comrades, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, and the lawyer for slaveholders, John Adams. And because we did not support this so-called Republican experiment, we've been treated ever since as if we're criminals in waiting, that we cannot wait to disrupt the status quo. And of course, the police departments, which arise out of the slave patrols of the slave South, still tend to treat us like we're criminals in waiting. And that's why I suggest that it's not enough to reform police departments, although certainly that should be high on the agenda. We really need a deeper interrogation of the nature of state power, of the nature of white supremacy, and of the nature of the capitalism that was driven by the labors of enslaved Africans.
Gerald Horn is our guest. We're talking to Gerald from Houston, Texas. He is a professor of history at the University of Houston and the author of many, many books, including Race to Revolution, the U.S. and Cuba During Slavery, and Jim Crow. We'll talk about some of his other books towards the end of this segment. Gerald, I've been basically in the street for, you know, the past week, along with so many other people here in Washington, D.C. and around the country. The evolution of the protests is very significant and very noteworthy. When people first came out, the police attacked. They used batons, pepper spray, tear gas, even and mainly against peaceful protesters. A couple people might throw a water bottle or something, but then there would be this huge barrage. And people ran. When the police attacked, they ran. And then when the police attacked again, they ran again. By about the second day, they stopped running. And people said, don't run, don't run. And people started to tend to the wounded. They started to identify people who they thought might be provocateurs in the crowd. And of course, I'm not suggesting that everybody throwing something was a provocateur. But for the main, people became very alert. They became self-organized. And you're right, there wasn't any single organization that was directing, but there became not really a model of organization, but an organic organization, like a community of resistance. And people learned lessons very, very rapidly. And I think the same process, based on my discussions with people around the country, have been happening. And there is this sense, or at least there has been the sense that may shift now, a sense of kind of insurrection, rebellion, embryonic revolution, those kind of feelings. On Sunday night here in Washington, D.C., there were small groups of people who were engaged in looting, and it was pretty widespread. And they were very, very small, and the police allowed it to happen. It was kind of like what happened on J20, January 20th, Trump's inauguration, but in slow motion. The police could have stopped it. Where I was, there were hundreds and hundreds of police watching and not just even setting up a police line. And they were obviously creating a video montage so that they could demonize the protests and the mass movement as nothing but, quote, looters and opportunists. And that became the pretext or the basis for Trump to declare near martial law on Monday, where he promised to invade different states in the United States unless their governors violently suppressed the demos ahead of time. And then he ordered peaceful protesters, including our producer, Nicole Roussel, who showed the press her media pass on Monday outside the White House in front of St. John's Church. They looked her in the eye and then they shot her. They shot her seven times with Stinger grenades and rubber bullets, and they shot a lot of other people. And that was this kind of show of force. And then last night, instead of everybody falling in line and being intimidated, the crowd sizes tripled and quadrupled all over the country. And we went through another day, another sort of different day, another iteration of this unfolding drama. When you think about it, of course, we're not in a revolutionary moment in the sense that there's going to be a power shift, but there's the dynamic of masses of people coming into political life, struggling with authorities, learning lessons. A very, very dynamic movement from which it would seem to me new organizations, if it were to sustain, are likely to grow. Anyway, your thoughts in sort of a historical perspective.
Well, let us hope that you are correct. And certainly I would say, as and to repeat, that we need a deeper understanding of what we're confronting. And having said that, I would also like to emphasize and stress what I consider to be one of the most significant aspects of what we're experiencing, and that are the global protests in Auckland, New Zealand, Sydney, Australia, London, England, again today in London, England, Berlin, Germany, in France, where there has been sort of a spinoff of the George Floyd protests. And most importantly, the fact that in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, a representative of the African Union, the continental-wide body representing 4 dozen-plus African states, called on the carpet the U.S. delegate there to upbraid him and read him the riot act with regard to what's going on in the United States with regard to black people. This is significant and profound because we all know that because of oftentimes the negative correlation of forces that black people face in North America, given the prevalence of white supremacy across class lines, that we oftentimes needed the international support and international solidarity, and that is certainly present. Let me also say that we should take very seriously what you just suggested concerning provocateurs. Those who may not remember should recall the disgusting episode of the man known as Tommy the Traveler. Plug that name into your search engine, and you will find an individual who specialized in disrupting nation movements. And of course, we're all familiar with COINTELPRO, the counterintelligence program of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, within walking distance of where you're sitting, which initially tried to disrupt the Communist Party and people in their orbit, such as Paul Robeson, but eventually expanded its remit to include Martin Luther King, the Black Panther Party, et al. And, of course, we should pay careful attention to this statement in the Washington Post that was said by a former CIA analyst that, and she said this quite nervously and worriedly, that what she's seeing in the streets of the United States reminds her of what she has witnessed abroad, and perhaps even helped to engineer abroad, when a state is on the verge of collapse. Now, I don't think the U.S. state is on the verge of collapse, but then again, I've been wrong before. But certainly we must take seriously the fact that unlike the 1960s, these protests have spread quite rapidly into Tony precincts and posh neighborhoods like Beverly Hills, like Soho and Lower Manhattan, like Buckhead and Atlanta. And I've seen graffiti raising the rather striking slogan of, quote, eat the rich, unquote, which I interpret as an attack on the 1% and their depredations that have driven this small planet to the brink of extinction. Similarly, I think we must take very seriously the comment by Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon, commenting on this disgusting episode of Mr. Trump with the head of the military in battle fatigues, no less, marching from the White House across the street to a boarded up church for a photo opportunity with Mr. Trump holding the Bible. Of course, he's not a regular churchgoer. That's no secret. But not only that, but then rousting and routing the peaceful protesters in the streets at the church, which of course brought condemnation from clerics in Washington and elsewhere, but was designed to appeal to his so-called Christian evangelical base, which, by the way, does not seem to be eroding in their support of their man, which is the most ominous and dangerous signal of all.
Dr. Horn, I want to ask you about some parallels that we may or may not be seeing between now and the 1968 riots. I found a couple of quotes today that I thought were really on point, and I wanted to get your thoughts. The first is Lyndon Johnson talking about the 68 riots. He said this: "What did you expect? I don't know why you're surprised. When you put your foot on a man's neck and hold him down for 300 years, and then you let him up, what's he going to do? He's going to knock your block off." Hubert Humphrey, visiting an urban ghetto in 1962, said this: "As hot as it has been, I would hate to be stuck on the fourth floor of a tenement with the rats nibbling on the kids' toes, and they do, with the garbage uncollected, and it is, with the streets filthy, with no swimming pools, with little or no recreation. I would hate to be put in those conditions, and I want to tell you, if I were in those conditions, if that should happen to have been my situation, I have enough spark left in me to lead a mighty good revolt under those conditions." Things, it seems, haven't changed terribly much since 1962 or 1968.
I'm afraid that you're correct, and to put President Johnson's comment in context, we need to realize how the times shaped the individual. The times in 1968 being rising national liberation movements, a seemingly thriving socialist camp, a movement that included not only the Black Panther Party, but included as well Dr. Martin Luther King's organization, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and the Congress on Racial Equality, et cetera. And so that kind of momentum and that kind of organized resistance was so illuminating and so enlightening that even President Johnson could not ignore it. And likewise, with regard to the comments of Hubert Horatio Humphrey, I think he's putting the finger on something we need to explore more deeply, which is that it's this economic inequality that in part is the complement to the white supremacy and racism that is driving people into the streets. That is to say, the 45th U.S. president has been very kind to the 1%, not least with this December 2017 tax cut to the wealthy, not least with the bailouts and handouts to the 1% that have punctuated and accentuated the response to the pandemic that is still roaring through our cities and through the countryside, but also with his working in overtime to make sure that the federal courts are festooned with the like-minded who will also be generous and kind to the 1%. They're being pushed through the U.S. Senate as we speak. And so certainly, I think that we have an uphill climb in the United States of America, but given the gathering international support and given the fact that the momentum in the streets does not seem to be ceasing, I think it becomes to be possible to be optimistic with every passing day.
That's the voice of Dr. Gerald Horn. We're talking to Gerald Horn to get the big picture, a bird's eye view of the sweeping mass protests that have taken place all around the country in cities and towns, big and small. I was just talking to folks in Western New York. You mentioned Tommy the Traveler, which was kind of funny because I was a political activist at the time that Tommy the Traveler was entrapping people in the area that I lived in, which is in Western New York. He was at Hobart College and other places, Geneva, New York, a small town where, by the way, there are mass protests going on, relative mass meaning for Geneva right now. And in Rochester, you know, we have a situation where, Gerald, where the people have, you know, we've seen time after time after time in the last 20 years, lots of mass movements come into existence. There was the anti-globalization movement that sort of started up. Well, it was especially in the countries of the South in the 90s, and then it came to Seattle in 1999. Then there was a September 11th, and that movement collapsed, but a new mass anti-war movement started up, and that was and brought in millions. That sort of ended in a couple of years. Then there was a mass immigrant rights movement. There was a general strike of immigrant workers, first general strike in a long time in the U.S. 13 million people went on strike May 1st, 2006. Then there was the Occupy movement in 2011, the Black Lives Matter movement in 2014, the Bernie Sanders movement, which really was kind of a movement, although it took an electoral form in both 2016 and 2020. All of these indicators that beneath the surface, there are movements ready and in fact do spring up. And then absent organization, they sort of spontaneously hit their peak and then they ebb. And, you know, it goes on and on and on. But undoubtedly, you can see a thread here where there's a desire for change and a lot of activism and a lot of looking for answers. We have here now something that I think is profoundly important because it's in the streets, as you can see here in Washington, New York. The anchor of the protests in many ways are Black people and particularly Black young people, but there's a lot of Latino people, there's Asian Americans, there's a lot of white people. It's not just young, it's young and old. It's very, in fact, lack of a better term, multiracial. There's a lot of unity in the streets, and at the same time, a feeling of complete sort of the irrelevance of the Democratic Party. Nobody's thinking, oh, I only hope Joe Biden can beat Donald Trump. People are not thinking about that at all on the street. They're not concerned about it. They're not thinking about it. It's very still in its early, as I would say, embryonic stage. And of course, we don't know where it goes. But again, it's another manifestation of this profound desire for change, which manifests itself in different kinds of activism.
Well, you are correct. And what your comments tend to suggest, if I may interpret your comments, is that certainly our movement and this term that you use, our multiracial movement, perhaps even a multi-class movement, because there are many middle class and working class people in the streets as well. Obviously, we need a general staff, so to speak, because it's very difficult to confront state power, this centralized Leviathan that we're going toe-to-toe with face-to-face while we're existing in a sort of decentralized, diffuse form. Having said that, I think when historians look back on this period, one of the issues and one of the episodes historians will focus on is the fact that also the headquarters of the AFL-CIO was defaced and disfigured by certain protesters. Now, of course, if there are contradictions between the movement and the AFL-CIO, the labor movement, they are secondary and tertiary. But at the same time, I think that what that bespeaks is a reform movement that needs to take place within organized labor, which should start with the leadership of organized labor apologizing to the international community for the terrible role that AFL-CIO representatives have played in destabilizing labor movements all over the world, which has only been self-defeating because it's helped to propel low-wage shops and low-wage havens abroad and runaway jobs from the United States to places elsewhere where workers can be oppressed and persecuted. So with regard to this question of developing a sounder leadership that can propel this movement further, I think that part of that process should start with the U.S. labor movement. And part of the process I do think should start with the press. I've been paying very careful and close attention to the attacks on the press, not only the attacks on the left press, which you just articulated, but even the attacks on the corporate media. The fact that Omar Jimenez, an Afro-Latino reporter in Minneapolis, was singled out for being handcuffed by the authorities. That was a very dangerous signal. And it's of a piece with these hints of so-called martial law, which would mean a suspension of civil liberty, suspension of the Fourth Amendment prohibition against unlawful searches and seizures. This is a very positive and optimistic moment that we're now facing, but it's also a very dangerous and ominous moment that we're facing.
Professor, I want to ask you another question about policy. In 1968, just 6 days after the riots began, after the murder of Martin Luther King, Congress updated or augmented the Civil Rights Act. Congress was quick to act. They wanted to do something to try to stop the violence and to try to begin bringing Americans together. We've seen no such action on Capitol Hill in the last 9 days. Do you anticipate anything at all, any leadership at all coming from Capitol Hill? And if the answer is yes, what form might that take?
Well, that's a very difficult question to answer. Just a few days ago, I was criticizing our friends in the Congressional Black Caucus and the Progressive Caucus on Capitol Hill because they voted overwhelmingly, those that did vote, in favor of sanctions against the leadership of the People's Republic of China for alleged human rights violations in Western China. My riposte to that particular maneuver is that our friends in the CBC and the Progressive Caucus really should be uniting with the international community, including Chinese leaders, to impose sanctions upon U.S. leaders for their dereliction and their delinquency in protecting the basic human rights of those who reside in North America, not least the black citizens of the United States of America, who obviously are being persecuted and even tortured into death horrendously. But I'm afraid to say, with regard to that particular issue, I do not necessarily anticipate a 180-degree reversal. However, I do think that possibly we can expect, for example, hearings in the House Judiciary Committee headed by Jerry Nadler of New York with regard to police violence. I think that perhaps we can see a cessation of these military weapons going into police departments, which is obviously a lunacy of the first order. Perhaps we can see an attempt to convert police departments from being occupying Marines or military forces into being more like social workers. There's a movement afoot already like that in Minneapolis that merits support. And I should also say that I've been heartened by the response from some of our entertainers and actors and singers, who, by the way, have a lot of time on their hands since they're housebound like the rest of us, but still offering money to bail out the protesters, going online with their social media, and some of them even coming to the front line, believe it or not. So once again, that is a reason for optimism.
Gerald, a final question. Obviously, Donald Trump has opted for his new 2020 election campaign strategy. A couple of months ago, it was bash China, but now it's moved on. He's a creative individual. It's moved on. It's the law and order. He's the law and order guy. It's Nixon's 1968 law and order strategy. At the same time, you have former Bush administration alumni officials forming a PAC together to support Joe Biden, who they're lifelong Republicans. Obviously, the elites of both sides of the political aisle are concerned that Donald Trump is the inciter in chief and inciting rebellions and inciting mass protests and not succeeding at maintaining the stability of the empire or the system at home. Anyway, if you had to look down the road and know that there are some battleground states, this is going to be Trump's strategy. Do you think right now in those battleground states he might be stronger or weaker as a consequence of the last week and this new, it's not a brand new pose, but it's a clearly identified go-to pose for the coming campaign?
It's hard to say. First of all, we have to take into account in terms of these elections, voter suppression. We have to take into account the attempt to cripple the post office, which obviously will hamper mail-in ballots as well. We also have to take into account on the other side of the ledger that this is not 1968. That is to say that Mr. Trump is not running for election. He's running for re-election. And he has a rather disturbing record that he has to run on, including mass unemployment, a collapsing economy, a pandemic, and pandemonium in the streets. And with regard to the so-called dissident Republicans, as has been said before me, I think there are enough of them to have a dinner party, but not enough to form a political party. In any event, they're culpable. Think of the bow-tied popinjay George Will, who writes drivel in the Washington Post on a regular basis. He's turned against the president, and I say right on, George. But then again, he should apologize for all the damage that he's inflicted, helping to drive this country to the brink of a precipice and the brink of a disaster, and now all of a sudden getting a religion and turning around and wanting to join with the rest of us. Well, okay, fine. He can join with the rest of us, but we should watch him with a jaundiced eye and look at him quite suspiciously. And I would say the same thing to a certain degree, or perhaps to a lesser degree, for the Lincoln Project, headed by George Conway, the spouse of Kellyanne Conway, the president's chief counselor, because they have done some good work in terms of these ads they're running in battleground states. But then again, we already know that even though the polling data has not formulated as of yet, when it does formulate, I would suspect that Mr. Trump's popularity rating will still be in the 40s, believe it or not, which bespeaks a hardcore, hardline base within the Euro-American community, not least the working class and middle class.
We will leave it right there. We were happy to be joined from Houston, Texas, by Dr. Gerald Horn. He's a professor of history at the University of Houston and the author of many books, including Race to Revolution, the U.S. and Cuba During Slavery, and Jim Crow. You are listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll be back with a lot more.
Loud and Clear.